Genesis 18. I'm going to take a few thoughts out of some of our reading. I didn't plan on doing this, but as we were reading through this week, it struck me, and so here we are. Genesis 18. I want to start in verse 9. This is where the Lord comes to visit Abraham and Sarah. They're getting ready to make the announcement again that Sarah is going to conceive. And so we'll start in verse 9 here. It says, "And they said unto him," that is, they said to Abraham, "Where is Sarah thy wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." And he said, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life. And lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son." And Sarah heard it in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age, and it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said unto Abraham, "Wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I of a surety bear a child, which am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son.' Then Sarah denied, saying, 'I laughed not,' for she was afraid. And he said, 'Nay, but thou didst laugh.'" And so the title of the message for this afternoon is just "Sarah Laughed." Sarah laughed. This is a familiar story for us. It might seem, even on the outset, as kind of a silly title, "Sarah Laughed." But as we think about this, there may be more to Sarah's laugh that overlaps our life than we think at face value. I don't know what you think of whenever you think about this story. It's a familiar story. If you were reading in Genesis, then you've read in Genesis before, then you knew this story was going to be pretty close to the beginning. It's part of the big drama of God promising a child to Abraham and waiting on that child to come. For us, it's a few chapters to read, and then we see that Isaac is born after some time. When I read this section the other morning, one of the thoughts that came to my mind was that while Abraham's story and this particular section of the story is just a few chapters for us, we're talking about years and years and years for Sarah. As a matter of fact, from the time that God promised Abraham that they would have a seed until this time, we're talking about 24 years. 24 years of an expectation that had not yet been met. 24 years, as we'll see in a few minutes, of a very strange life circumstance that Sarah lived in. And so when I'm reading this and I'm thinking about this, and when I think about Scripture in general, I typically try to ask questions whenever I'm looking at it. And so the question that I have is, why in the world would Sarah laugh? I mean, it tells us. She laughed and she said to herself, "Now that I'm old and now that my husband is old, is God going to give me a child?" So, you know, we get the thoughts that she had, but why would Sarah laugh during a time like that? And what I think is very possible is that perhaps the reason Sarah laughed is because it was a lot easier to laugh than it was to cry at that point. I don't think when Sarah laughed here, it was one of those funny ha-ha laughs, as if years down the road she would say, "Hey, did I tell you the one about when the Lord came and said I was going to have a child?" And then hit the punchline for the rest of the party to laugh. I don't think that was the kind of laugh. I think what we see in Sarah here and what we really can relate to ourselves in a lot of ways is cynicism. Cynicism over what the Lord had promised. A cynical spirit. a cynical attitude. And you know what I mean by a cynical attitude. Yeah, right. It's the same kind of attitude we get whenever we are really hoping that something is going to happen and it just doesn't. We're really hoping that we're going to get fill in the blank and it doesn't. And after a while, we can become cynical. We can have a yeah right type attitude, and it's easy to be cynical in a fallen world, isn't it? It really is. It's a lot more natural than maybe even we're aware of. It's fairly natural for the, when we think in just general terms, it's pretty natural for the older generation to be cynical of the younger generation who is more liberal in their ways and who don't hold to the strict standards that folks think they ought to hold to. And it's natural for the younger generation to be more cynical of the older generation who are out of touch with reality and they don't really understand. And it's normal to be, I say normal, it's natural, it comes fairly natural to become cynical of people who you have tried to help who just won't receive that help, for people that you have hoped would change who just won't change. It's even natural and fairly easy to become cynical with yourself whenever you get to thinking about changes that need to be made in your own life and how long those changes have needed to be made, and yet they haven't. At this point, there's no doubt in my mind that somewhere out there in the congregation is someone who either has been or is currently cynical about the idea of keeping a regular Bible study. Maybe this is year 23, 24, 25. Maybe it's just year 4 or 5. Maybe you've struggled with spiritual growth for years. And so we have a couple of services on Wednesday nights to try to help you and encourage you. And as good as all that stuff is, somewhere in the back of somebody's mind is, I know myself well enough to know, as good as this stuff is, it's not going to help me. I'm going to fall off like I always do. I'm not going to be the leader that I hope to be. I'm not going to be the spiritual man or woman that God wants me to be. I kind of wish I were, but I'm just not. It's easy to be cynical in a fallen world. And here's the reality about cynicism. This is the reality about Sarah. It's the reality about us. A cynical attitude feeds off of our circumstances, doesn't it? It just feeds off of circumstances. Now, we're not here yet, but I'll go ahead and get to the response. You know, Sarah says, me have a baby this old, and Abraham is this old, and more than likely they haven't even thought about trying to have a baby in years. And what does the Lord say? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? What the Lord does is he asks a question that obviously the only answer that Sarah could give would be no. And the reality is, so many times we can get our eyes glued to our circumstances and become so cynical because we have forgotten, grown dull to, or drowned out the realities of God's character and how God works, moves, and cares for his people. That's easy to do. So, I don't know how cynical you are this afternoon. I don't know what areas you tend to be cynical in, but I think we could all at least identify in some way with where Sarah is here. Let me give you another just principle here that we'll look at. Typically, a cynical spirit, a yeah right type attitude, is produced through both sin and suffering. Okay? Suffering and unbelief. Now, anybody in here just gravitate toward cynical people? Anybody love people who just have a cynical attitude? A yeah right type attitude? No hands for that one? And yet we all struggle with it, don't we? I do. It just depends on what area that we're talking about. But I can get very cynical very quickly. And some of it is because, some of it really is because of unbelief. See, Sarah had been told, at this point, had been told already that she was going to have a child, that God was going to bless her to have a child. And yet, whenever he comes to make the announcement a year before it happens, she laughs. She laughs in unbelief. You know, the promise is to Abraham, and it's implied in Genesis chapter 12. If you have your Bibles, we'll go ahead and turn there. It's implied that Sarah would be the one. It's not straight out given that she is. Look in Genesis chapter 12, starting in verse 4. So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. So Abraham's 75 here. And Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. And Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there built he an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Hai on the east. And there he built an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abraham journeyed, going on still toward the south. So God calls Abraham out of his land. He calls him to go. In verse 2, he says that he's going to make a great nation out of him. He's going to make his name great, and there's going to be this great offspring. And so what Abraham does is he, when he's 75, he packs up his family and he moves. Now again, we know the story, but what that also means is that whenever Abraham was 75, he told Sarah, we're leaving, right? Which is not bad, it's just what happened. Sarah left her family, left everything that she knew, was uprooted from everything that was normal to her. God promises to Abraham that he's going to have a great seed upon the earth. And like I said earlier, in chapter 12, the fact that Sarah was his wife, I would say it's a pretty good implication that God was going to use her to bring forth that seed. Okay? Now here's what happens with the rest of Sarah's life. In the rest of chapter 12, you read that there was a famine in the land. Abraham goes to Egypt, and he is terrified that the people in Egypt are going to be think that his wife is so beautiful that they will kill him in order to have her. And so Abraham says, Honey, tell them I'm your brother, because I really am, right, or have. Tell them that I'm your brother, it'll go better for me. And so Sarah goes and is taken into the king of Egypt's harem, because it would be better for her to go there and potentially be violated there than it would be for Abraham to be harmed or killed on her behalf. Sound like a good start to a new move? Well, the king of Egypt figures out that she is not his sister, she's his wife, and confronts Abraham, and Abraham essentially says, the reason this happened is because I was scared. Abraham says, leave, And somehow or another, when Abraham says, "Come on, honey," Sarah decides to go with him. "Come on, let's get out of here." And she goes. They go into the land. Next thing that happens is they begin to have a bit of a competition between Abraham and Sarah and their livestock and cattle, and Lot and his livestock, cattle, and workers. And so after the whole Egypt ordeal, the next thing that happens is Sarah's ungrateful nephew takes advantage of Abraham and his generosity and occupies the best part of the land that they have. Well, as time goes on and Sarah waits, it's been about 11 years, I think, close to it. She still does not have a baby. And so she gets the idea that if she gives her concubine, Hagar, to Abraham, or she gives her servant, Hagar, to Abraham as his concubine, that might be what God uses. And so she gives Hagar to Abraham. By the way, as you're reading Genesis and you come across things like that and you think, that is really, really weird, that's because it is really, really weird, okay? Now, I'll say this, though. You know what else would be really, really weird? And I'm not equating it with this, but I'm going to make a bigger point. What else would be really, really weird is if we sent a narrative of, let's just say it was a narrative of one of our children's birthday parties back in time, and they were to read that we went into a place and there was music and lights flashing and a mouse the size of a man was walking on two legs, dancing around, and some of the little ones cried and some of them smiled and they had pizza. That would be very weird, okay? Now, I'm not equating that with that, but what I'm saying is things make sense in a cultural context. As odd as that was for Sarah to do that, in that cultural context, that was a normal thing, okay? Doesn't mean it's acceptable. Doesn't mean it's not sin. It means when God called Abraham out of Ur, and as God begins to make, you know, we're in the budding stages here of God making a nation, which would be a picture of his people that would be indwelt by his Spirit. God finds them where they are, and he begins to sanctify them in a process. So don't read this and think God was okay with these weird things. They were normal within the culture. God allowed some things like that to happen. But if they seem weird, that's because they are weird. But in that culture, it wouldn't have been so weird. So, Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham as a concubine. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but it ended up backfiring on her, didn't it? Because as soon as she gives Hagar to Abraham, then Hagar conceives. And then, you know what happened after she conceived? Hagar just stopped acting right, didn't she? It does say that she despised Sarah, but you know what else happened that was probably, you'll have to use your sanctified imagination. What do you think happened whenever Hagar conceived? What do you think happened with Sarah? You know what was the one thing Sarah wanted probably more than anything was to have a baby? I'm sure Sarah became insanely bitter and jealous and upset. So that didn't work out, and she begins to mistreat Hagar and sends her away. You know what happens after that? God sends her right back. She has Ishmael. This is 11 years after the promise has been made, is whenever Hagar actually has Ishmael. And maybe after she had Ishmael, Sarah had kind of come to the conclusion, maybe accepted the fact that this great nation that God had promised Abraham, which we read back in chapter 12, maybe that was going to come through Hagar all along. So sometimes it's easier to accept defeat and disappointment than it is to keep on hoping. Except for the fact that 4 years later, God shows back up and tells Abraham it's Sarah who this seed is going to come through. Okay? Now again, if you're listening to this, and this may be coming across like this, but if you're listening to this like we already know all these facts, that's fine. I'm not trying to give you the facts. I'm trying to give you Sarah's story. This is what she lived. This is her experience. And so 15 years after the original promise that she had probably given up hope on, in chapter 17, God comes back and says, Ishmael's not the guy. Sarah's going to have a son. She's the one who I'm going to bring this line through. 9 years later, the Lord shows up on the plains of Mamre in Genesis chapter 18. And the Lord comes in when they are well beyond their years. No doubt her hopes of childbearing and the thought of that had gone away. It was just disappointing. It was just grievous. And when this guy shows up, who happened to be the Lord, who she didn't know, when this guy shows up and says, oh yeah, you know, you're gonna have a child next year, Sarah says, yeah, right. I heard that 25 years ago. That was before I was put into the king of Egypt's harem. That was before Lot got the good land. That was before Hagar and things with Hagar worked out so poorly. That was before all this heartache. And she says, yeah, right. Yeah, right. We've got to watch our expectations, don't we? We've got to watch our expectations. Because here's the truth. And if you've lived very long and you have any real self-awareness, you know this to be the case in your own life. God's promises are always true and amen, right? And God's promises rarely come to pass the way we think they're going to. They rarely come to pass the way we think they're going to. Rarely do they happen on our timetable. Rarely do they happen in the form which we think we're going to receive them. Often, they are initiated and developed through heartache and disappointment. And so we have to watch our expectations. It's easy to have a romanticized view of what the life of faith is supposed to be and what the life of faith is supposed to look like. And that's what we're talking about here, right? Genesis 11, Abraham's there, Sarah's there. Can you believe that? Can you believe God put Sarah in the hall of faith, as some people call it in Hebrews 11? The one who laughed probably in a cynical way. I say probably, we saw her reasoning. Whenever he came and said, you're going to have a child this time next year. We'll get to that in a minute as far as what that tells us. So we can get in trouble whenever we try to grade God's promises based on our expectations. The second thing we can get in trouble doing is when we try to interpret our disappointments. Okay, and that can be close to the same thing, but we try to interpret our disappointments. You remember back when, it's a little further along in our reading in Genesis, we're not there yet, but when there's another famine and Jacob sends his sons into Egypt and he thinks Joseph's dead and Joseph's actually the guy they're getting all their supplies from and puts the money back in the bags and sends them home, and except he keeps one of the boys, and then he wants him to send Benjamin there to stay with him, and Jacob is just overwhelmed with all of this. And you remember what he says? Joseph's not with me anymore. One of my sons stuck in Egypt. You want me to send another one? We're starving over here. All of these things are against me." You see, Jacob didn't have a circumstance problem. He had an interpretation problem, didn't he? His circumstances were the best possible scenario they could be. The fact was, Joseph was with him. Joseph was in the process of moving their family into a place to where they were going to be provided for by the hand of the Lord, but nevertheless, it was Joseph who was doing it. The son that was left behind was in far better shape than the ones that they had taken. The youngest that Joseph asked him to bring was going to receive more of the portion than the rest. And Jacob was going to be reunited with the son of his wife that he dearly loved and had lost. You see, Jacob didn't have a circumstance problem. He had an interpretation problem. And the interpretation went like this: I'm disappointed. God must not like me. This is painful. God must be mad at me. This is not what I was expecting. All these things are against me. It's easy to fall into that, isn't it? It is. It's very easy to fall into those sorts of things. Proverbs chapter 13, this is just a basic principle. In Proverbs chapter 13, verse 12, and I'm just going to get the first part of this. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. Well, that seems kind of common sense, doesn't it? When you're expecting something to happen, that's what hope is. And it doesn't happen on your timeline, that's what the deferred part is, it can make our hearts sick. Is that wrong in and of itself? Not necessarily. I mean, Solomon is not making a morality statement here. He's just stating the fact. When your expectations don't come to pass the way that you thought they would, your heart tends to be sick. Now, here's the morality part of it. Here's the sin or righteousness part of it. You better be careful what you do when your heart becomes sick with disappointment. You better be careful how you respond, how you react. You better be careful what you're constantly telling yourself in the midst of your disappointment. And you better be careful in how you're responding to those around you in the midst of disappointment. So that's the reality is, the non-moral, the neutral part is, when your expectations don't come to pass, you're going to be pretty vulnerable. That's normal. Now, what you do in that vulnerability is going to, that's going to be the other part of that, the part that you better watch out for, okay? The Lord comes, visits Abraham and Sarah. They tell Abraham that tell Sarah that she's going to have a child this time next year. Sarah laughs. Yeah, right. And then here's what he says: Is anything too hard for the Lord? Is anything too hard for the Lord? You know, it would be a fine message, I suppose, if I were to get up and tell you that you don't need to be cynical anymore. But that would probably be a waste of breath. It would probably be just as effective for you to tell me not to be cynical anymore. And I would say, okay, and we're at church, and we would leave, and that would be that. But the truth is, most of the time, we don't sign up for cynicism. Most of the time, we don't sign up for a yeah-right attitude. And the cure to a cynical, negative spirit is not stop being negative. Stop being cynical. The cure to a cynical attitude, a cynical spirit, is the sufficiency of God. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Is anything too hard for the Lord? This is something that's repeated again and again in Scripture. So in Numbers 11, whenever the people were whining because they wanted meat and they were tired of bread, and God tells Noah, I'm going to feed these people to the point that they're going to have meat coming out of their nostrils. And not Noah, Moses. And Moses says, Lord, there aren't enough fish in the sea to feed these people. And he says this, is the Lord's arm waxed too short to do this? Essentially, he says this, is there anything too difficult for the Lord? Is there anything too difficult for the Lord? In Jeremiah 32:27, he says this, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? And then here's one that you're very familiar with in Mark 10:27, after Jesus is describing the difficulty of the rich to enter into the kingdom of heaven, and the disciples say, well, who can be saved? And he says, well, with men this is impossible, but with God, what? All things are possible, right? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? And so one of the things that we're pointed toward in that is that God's grace is sufficient for our cynicism. God's grace is sufficient for a cynical attitude. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I'm just going to read verse 9. This is after Paul has asked for the thorn in his flesh to be removed 3 times. And finally in verse 9 it says, he said to me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmity, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. The part that I really want here is this. God says, my grace is sufficient. It's enough for you. And my strength is made perfect in your weakness. One of the things that we can glean from verse 9 is that until we come to grips with our own weakness, until we come to grips with our own inability, we will be fighting against the grace that God says is sufficient. You notice where the turn is. Paul goes from praying that God would take the thorn in the flesh away to saying, now I glory in my infirmity. I accept it. I'm going to own it. I'm going to glory in it, because where I'm weak, he's strong, right? Now, how does that make sense and apply to a cynical attitude, a cynical spirit? Well, cynicism has everything to do with failed expectations, and failed expectations have everything to do with our inability, don't they? I mean, if we were able to get things done the way we want them to be done, then we would have no reason to be cynical. So if I could get you to behave the way that I want you to behave, I'd never have to be cynical again. You would do exactly what I wanted you to do when I wanted you to do it. But I can't do that. You can't do that either. You see, God hasn't set you up as a chessboard for me to assign and this and that. And so when you don't, the first time I'm disappointed, the 10th or 15th time, I just come to expect it. And I feed my disappointment, right? Here's the reality. We're talking about Sarah, or we're talking about me or you. Until we come to the place to see that what we need more than our own desires and our own expectations is God's grace to respond to the trials and the events of life in a way that pleases God, then we won't see how weak we really are. We won't see how weak we really are. Until we see that what we need more than anything is God's grace, not our will, then we'll be fighting against that grace. It's in my weakness. Now, how many people like to meditate on how weak you are? I don't. It's embarrassing. It's frustrating. It's not pleasant. And yet that's exactly where God's grace comes into your life. right there in the middle of your weakness. That's where God shows up and says, my grace is enough. Is anything too hard for the Lord? You know what our typical answer to that is, don't you? We don't put it in these words, but we say, no, but I don't need them for this. No, it's not too hard for the Lord, but I don't need them. I'm good at this. They may need them, but I'm okay over here. No, nothing's too hard for the Lord, but I'm going to figure this one out. Nothing's too hard for the Lord, but I'm going to. And what the answer really should be is, nothing's too hard for the Lord. Lord, would you help? Would you give grace? Would you be merciful? Now, by the time we get to the end of this event in Genesis, it goes over to Genesis 21, we read about Sarah a year later who has her baby. And as she has Isaac, she says, it says that she was made to laugh again. And she named him Isaac, which means laughter, right? Son of laughter, laughter. If you ever wonder why Brother Isaac's so silly, they knew from the beginning. Her cynicism had turned into joy whenever her hope was realized, right? Whenever the Lord blessed her to be able to taste that promise. Here's the truth about God. Ephesians 3:20 says this, that he is able to do exceeding abundantly above, right? All that we ask or think according to his power that works in us. What do we get from that? It means, number one, God is able, and number two, God is at work in you. Okay? Romans 8:31, if God be for us, who can be against us? You see, all these are realities, truths that we ought to be interpreting our circumstances through. Do we go through scary times? Of course we do. Do we go through uncertain times? Of course we do. Do we go through frustrating times? Of course we do. Do we know how they're all going to turn out? Of course we don't. But you know what we do know? We know that God's for us. And that changes things. You know what we do know? We know that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we can ask or think, even when we can't see a good way out of or a good way forward. His power's working in us. And so Psalm 35 says, weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. That may be, we may realize that on earth, or we may realize that as we go to be with the Lord, where there is no more weeping and there are no more tears. We may realize that whenever the glory that's revealed is not worthy to be compared with the struggles that we have here on earth. Now, that doesn't minimize the struggles that we have. That doesn't minimize or downplay the difficulties that we go through. What it really tells us is this: when we think about what it means to be in glory, we really have no idea what we're talking about, do we? Anybody here want to volunteer to share your most hurtful experience that you've ever had and then say, but that's nothing. That was nothing. Probably not. Not if you're being honest. But what God says is, one of these days, we are going to be so aware and in tune to his presence, and we're going to be able to receive the light of the reality of who he is, and the joy that we're going to experience, and the bliss of what it's going to be, is going to be so intense that we will look back on those most painful moments, and at that time we'll think, compared to this, that was nothing. That's pretty amazing to think about, isn't it? No more cynical spirits there. No more attitudes of, yeah, right. Maybe for somebody else, but it's not for me. And so I just want to encourage you. There's nothing too hard for the Lord. So I don't know where you are. I know where some of you are, but I don't know where all of you are. I don't know what you have going on, but if you're struggling with a cynical attitude and a cynical spirit, can I encourage you? Spend a little bit of time in the Word. Spend a little bit of time meditating on God's goodness, the reality of God's character, in prayer with the Lord, with those things in mind. And my prayer and my expectation is not that you'll be zapped out all of a sudden, but you'll find help in your time of need.
Thank you for listening to this message. Our prayer is that you've been blessed by the messages and the daily devotional blog on sermon audio from Ripley Primitive Baptist Church. We would love the opportunity to be of greater service to you and your walk with Christ. In other words, we would like to get to know you better. Do you have need of counsel, of a home church, or can we just pray for you? Please feel free to contact us by phone at 662-837-8590 or visit our website at www.ripleypbc.com.